First, we will all experience the death of a loved one at least once in life, and more likely many times. But the ways in which we relate to the dead and dying and the rituals that surround that transition can vary a lot. Kevin Tulis is a journalist, filmmaker, and author. His family has lived in the same village on an island off the coast of County Mayo for the last 200 years. And his new book is My Father's Wake, How the Irish Teach Us How to Live, Love, and Die. Kevin, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Judith. Yeah, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Kevin, can you explain for those of us who haven't lived it what the Irish relationship to the dying and to death is?
Well, if you've never been to an Irish wake, you probably just think it's a few Irish drunks around a coffin. But you would be very much mistaken, because the wake is actually one of the oldest rites of humanity. It's mentioned in the Old Testament. It's mentioned in the Iliad, the poem that Homer wrote about the fall of Troy. And that poem was written in 800 BC. I mean, what the wake is it's a kind of ritual between obligations between the living and the dead. It's a form of sort of therapy, really, for where the mortal, the living, bond together in the face of the mortal. It's really the best lesson in life you could ever have, because there you have a dead human, one that you can reach out and touch, yet you're surrounded by your community, supported at often the worst moment of people's lives. That's what's so important about the wake.
You've experienced mortality and death in many ways throughout your life. Can you tell us about your hospital stay as a boy?
Well, what happened was I became a victim and a survivor of a very old disease, tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is a disease that has afflicted mankind for a million years. In the 19th century, in the industrial cities of across Europe and in America, one in four of the population died of tuberculosis. But it was actually a graduate student at Rutgers University in 1943 who discovered streptomycin, which was a kind of miracle cure. And around the world, in the Western world, certainly, tuberculosis began to die out. But in the 1970s, when I was still a child, I managed to contract that disease. But by that stage, all of the specialist tuberculosis hospitals, the sanitariums, had closed down. So I ended up, as an 11-year-old child, being sent to what was effectively a lung cancer ward. And I spent a whole summer in a place that was pretty much a sort of antechamber to hell of men who were actually dying of lung cancer. Because at that particular time in the 70s, then the other epidemic of cancers related to tobacco use was actually at its peak. And so it was a fairly, I could say, shocking experience for a relatively young, naive child to be confronted with that. And I suppose, this is such a strange time if for your listeners, and probably quite shocking, that the cancer ward did actually have a smoking lounge.
That was shocking to read.
Yeah, and then the nurses on their break would often go and sit in the smoking lounge along with the actual patients. And this was obviously, you know, several decades ago. So the actual kind of care that you would get, the drugs that we, you know, are around today, none of that was available. So in relative terms, the treatment for those lung cancers was fairly primitive. And your survival chances were very limited. Yet at the same time, some of the men on the ward had incredible dignity and incredible courage. And many of them were very kind to me as this sort of child passing through. And I look back on that, and from that ward, I am the only survivor. I mean, now time is long ago, but most of those men obviously died quite soon after I left that ward.
So you
it was a place that, yeah.
I was going to say, you saw all of that as a boy. You also lost a brother early in life. And then you also came face to face with death as a journalist, and you say you were on a death hunt. Explain that for us.
Well, what happened was, even despite this experience, you know, when you're a young man of 18, 19, 20, or a young woman, you often are, you know, infused with a sense of immortality, that somehow this won't happen to you. But I had a brother who died when he was 26 after a battle with leukemia, and I was 20. And it did have a very profound effect on me. I mean, I suppose I was in a kind of strange sense of mourning, not really for my dead brother. I think more selfishly, you know, for myself, for the 20-year-old who I thought, you know, should have been immortal, but who knew now that he wasn't. So I ended up drifting into Northern Ireland's troubles as a reporter. And I developed, I'd say, an acute and dangerous gift, not something that you particularly want to develop, but I became very good at sort of getting into people's houses and within about 5 or 10 minutes asking them about the worst things that ever happened to them in their lives. And the reason why I did that was I wanted to know basically how you lived in the aftermath of mortality, how you struggled, how you could be brave in irreversible sorrow, how you could continue to go on after what other people would thought would be just a completely irretrievable loss. So I really went around the world asking those questions, hoping that someone would give me the answer.
And Kevin, you decided to write your book, My Father's Wake, How the Irish Teach Us How to Live, Love, and Die, focusing on that particular loss and that transition. What inspired you to really delve into the last months, weeks, days of your father?
Well, it's not really a transition. You know, my father died, as we all die, as mortals. And to be, you know, to be human is to be mortal and to carry the burden of your mortality and to help others in grace carry their burden, sometimes lightly and sometimes courageously. Now, all of my death hunting around the world never solved the problem of my mortality. But when I was back on the island, embraced by the Irish wake, my father was dying of pancreatic cancer. What I discovered really was the best way that we can face this as an individual mortal is to face it together. And that we don't really have to rediscover anything. We just need to go back to the Irish wake, which is this really ancient human rite. So when my father was dying, people came to see him because they wanted to say goodbye. They weren't embarrassed about his death, and he never flinched away from his impending death either. And the reason why he didn't do that is because he had grown up in the Irish wake tradition as a child. He'd been around the bereaved. He'd seen dead bodies. He'd seen dozens and dozens of dead bodies. His community treated death as it is a very ordinary thing in life. There's an old Greek philosopher called Heraclitus who talks about the gods, and he says the gods are mortal and men are immortal, dying in each other's lives and living on in each other's death. And that is our perpetual story as humans.
And I think we lost Kevin, but we will get him back as soon as possible. Kevin Tulis is a journalist, filmmaker, and author. His new book is My Father's Wake, How the Irish Teach Us How to Live, Love, and Die. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How intimately have you experienced death? Do the Irish traditions appeal to you, or is it too personal an experience of mortality? Does your family or your culture have particular death rituals that are meaningful to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're continuing the conversation with author Kevin Tulis about his book, My Father's Wake, How the Irish Teach Us How to Live, love, and die. And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you embrace death as a part of the life cycle, or do you prefer to keep it as distant from everyday life as possible? How much have you thought about how you'd like to be remembered and seen off? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kevin, you talk about the Western death machine. What does that mean to you?
Well, really what's happened in the last two centuries in the Western world is through urbanization and medicalization that we basically separated the living from the dying. That, you know, ask your listeners, how often do you go to a funeral? How often, when was the last time you saw or touched a dead human, a dead one of us? I mean, I'm speaking to you from the close to the ruins of an old village, Dukanella on Achill Island, where my family are from. A village which was one of the, and still is, one of the archives of the oldest faith of humanity. This belief in the Irish wake, in a kind of open acceptance of death. And, you know, our ancestors were basically far more comfortable around death than we are. And we often, the narrative is we see death as a sort of tragedy, an individual catastrophe, people go on all these runs against cancer and et cetera. But we don't visit the sick and dying. We have very little experience of what it is like for those around us to die, how we support them. How often do we go to funerals? Now, in the Irish wake tradition, you go a lot more often than we do in the Western death machine. And people are a lot more comfortable around death and dying, and they're bereaved. They don't feel embarrassed about, you know, crossing the office floor and shaking the hand of a colleague and saying, I'm really sorry about the death of your mother. Even it is a common American euphemism, but we talk about past and passing as opposed to what it really is. Dying and dead.
Let's go to our callers now. Jane in Sun Prairie is up first. Hi, Jane.
Hello. Thank you for taking me.
Of course.
My daughter was murdered as she left work on February 2nd of 2016. She was 24. And on the first anniversary, I planned to do some private things, and then it turned out that a vigil was planned. So I modified my plans, and I did a keening ceremony. I sang in Irish and English. I danced. We had music. And we took a just like 2 gallons of holy water and poured it on the ground where she fell. And all kinds of people came forward, and we had our hands in it. We were washing the evil that happened on that spot away, and we sent her on her way.
Wow. Jane, I'm so sorry for your loss, and thank you very much for sharing that with us. Kevin, that reminds me of a lot that you wrote about in your book.
Well, it's important that we do have these rituals, that, you know, why we wake with the dead body through the night. It's like a wake is a bit like training for a marathon. If you knew that you were going to run a marathon, you had to run a marathon, and the whistle went off, and there was no warning, or someone you loved had to run that marathon, then it would be a really good idea to have a few practice laps to see what it's like, to see how other people are like in that situation, to know what to do. You know, we practice to learn how to drive. We practice to learn a foreign language. Going to the Irish wake is like a little bit of practicing about what it is to be mortal.
Thanks again for that call, Jane. Let's go next to Molly in Brookfield. Hi, Molly.
Hi. I just wanted to say I think it's very important that when a person is facing their own mortality, their own death, that those around them who give support, they need to listen to them. Because I know when my sister was dying of cancer, she so badly wanted to talk about her death, but nobody would do it. I did. I finally sat down and did it with her, but everybody kept saying, You're going to beat this. We're not going to talk about a funeral. We're not going to do this. But it was important, and she needed to have that conversation. As hard as it was, but I had to do it.
That's a great point, Molly. And Kevin, there is something that this isn't just for the people who are going to survive this. It's also for the person who's dying. How did your father respond as his end was coming?
Well, my father, you know, was quite stoic about it because he had experience of this by going to Irish wakes himself. And being his community had obviously gone through this experience many, many times before. Now, you are allowed to deny your death. You know, you're allowed in that personal circumstance. But one of the things my father, Sonny, taught me, the last parental lesson of all, is you have to teach your children how to die. Yeah? It may sound really strange, but of course that is the endless human story. It's not that we've just suddenly become, you know, this particular generation have discovered death. It's always kind of funny how teenagers, you know, rediscover sex and are both embarrassed and thrilled by it. But we somehow do the same about death. Somehow we think, my goodness, it's like we're the first generation that have died. But of course we are the 100,000th human generation who've died. And we just need to take those lessons of the past and the wisdom of the past with us.
Molly, thank you for that call, and I'm sorry for the loss of your sister. Catherine in Milwaukee is up next. Hi, Catherine.
Hello. Yes, my experience and my personal belief about death is that the body dies, but the consciousness, the spirit, goes on. And from everything that I've experienced in my life and have learned about, I really believe that when the person leaves their body, their soul, they're greeted by loved ones from the other side. There's so many people that have gone through near-death experiences. And I've experienced my own father's death and recently the death of an ex-husband of mine. And I know and feel that they are, first of all, relieved from their pain, secondly, greeted by loved ones, and spiritually, they are going on to keep learning and growing in their consciousness, keep evolving, because the body is only a shell, and the spirit and soul goes on always.
Thank you very much for sharing that, Catherine. And Kevin, does that resonate with you?
Well, I disagree with the idea that the body is a shell. It's very important. Our ancestors, you know, spend a lot of time caring for the bodies of the dead. And I think that's really important too. It's really important that we actually see and touch our personal dead, that it's not just, they're not something that's unimportant. And the reverence, like in the Iliad, there's a sort of famous scene in it where the Trojan king, he goes to rescue his son Hector. And people say, oh, don't go there, the Greeks are going to kill you. And he says, I don't care if they kill me as long as I have the heart comforting embrace of my dead son in my arms. And so the bodies of our dead, of those that we love, are hugely important. And our ancestors obviously lavished huge amounts of love and attention, caring for those bodies, and making sure that they went off to the afterlife with as much care and dignity as possible. And we still fundamentally believe that it's important that people are given a proper burial. It's just that we've somehow shied away from the physicality of the dead. And I think that's something that we need to rediscover, the physicality of seeing and touching your beloved dead.
Thank you for that call, Catherine. I want to make sure we have time for Carol in Racine before we run out of time. Hi, Carol.
Hi. My name is Carol. I live in Racine. I try to look for comfort. I just lost my son a month ago, and it's not easy. He was only 48 years old. I know he was in a lot of physical pain. We don't know what he died from. He had his pajamas on. He died sitting in a chair, and he keeled over. He just flopped over. And I just talked to him on the phone at 9:30 that night on a Monday night, and by Tuesday morning they called me and said, come down to the office, we want to talk to you. They told me, the coroner said, your son is dead. I said, no, he's not. It's very, very hard.
Carol, I'm so sorry for your loss and that it's so recent and fresh for you. And Kevin, you know, kind of going back to what you were saying, you know, having that real sense of community and that you're not in it alone. I feel like that's part of what we have lost in the West with being kind of arm's length from death and dying.
Well, I'm sorry for your loss, Carol, too. And I think that is the point, is that we carry the burden more lightly by having more hands. And the more open and honest that we are, the fact if we participate in these rituals, if you know, not just, you know, once in our own family, but if we reach out to our neighbors, it's that really simple. It's that you hear of someone, maybe a work colleague who's sick or dying, and instead of sort of shunning them and thinking, oh, they won't want any kind of contact, just make an attempt to reach out, you know, call them, go round to see them, offer to help. If you're actually the person who's doing the dying, this may sound strange, but try and share your death. Ask for help, because what you're doing is something that's incredibly kind of human. Dying is a really exhausting process, and you're going to need help. And if you think about it, the one first best hope of humanity is that you will be born in a community who will love you. And we think it's terrible for a child who's born to parents who don't love him or community or her. The last best hope.
Thank you so much for joining us, Kevin, and spending time with us. Kevin Tulis is a journalist, filmmaker, and author. His family's lived in the same village on an island off the coast of County Mayo for the last 200 years, and he joined us to talk about his new book, which is titled My Father's Wake: How the Irish Teach Us How to Live, Love, and Die.